Welcome back to America Weekend. I'm Valerie Smaldone. A few weeks ago, I had author Clara Bingham on the show as we discussed her new book with a long title, Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Now, Clara's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker as well. She chose to focus on one year in this book, from August 1969 to September 1970, when so many of the decade's signature events occurred. Welcome back to America Weekend, Clara.
Thank you for having me, Valerie, and for figuring out how to pronounce all of those long words in the subtitle. It's a bit of a twister.
It is, but the book is dense with information, and the last time we spoke, it was more like an overview of the events that occurred during that year in American history and how it really changed our country. Today, what I'd like to do is go a little bit deeper into the interviews you did and really talk about some of the compelling stories.
Great.
So first, let's talk about getting those interviews. How long did it take you to actually procure the contacts, get the interviews, and do them? What was that period of time like?
I spent approximately 3 years traveling around the country, hunting down people who would talk to me, who would share their stories with me. And I had a specific chronology that I'd worked out ahead of time. So I knew that I wanted to focus on the school year of 69-70 and roughly August to August. And then I pinpointed the events of that year. And there were so many. I just picked a few, but big ones like the moratorium to end the war, which was in October, the Chicago 8 trial, which started in September, Woodstock, which was in August, then later moving into the My Lai massacre, which was revealed in November, and Fred Hampton's murder, the Black Panther in December. So there were events all the way through. And I then tried to find people who had witnessed those events, mm-hmm. and who were there and could tell me very specifically what it was like. Kent State, for example, in May, I found 8 people who were at Kent State at the time of the shooting when the National Guard shot 13 students and killed 4 of them. And so that was I had to sort of sleuth it out, figure out who I needed and for what exact, period of time.
There's a lot of pre-production that goes into this kind of a book. There's a lot of work and planning, as you mentioned. So with those stories, you interviewed famous people and not so famous people. Let's talk about some of the famous people that you were able to get.
I was able to get some of the really iconic, important activists of the time. Daniel Ellsberg, for example, who, when I interviewed him at his house in Berkeley, was 83 years old, and he's the person who your listeners probably know released the Pentagon Papers to the press, and he is a fascinating character. I actually begin the book with him in August because he went to a peace conference and listened to a draft resistor who was telling the story of how he was going to resist the draft and go to jail instead. And because of that, Dan Ellsberg was so moved by the fact that this young man who had just graduated from Harvard was going to give up 2 to 3 years of his life instead of going to jail. And he realized that Dan himself needed to do the same thing, and he needed to do whatever he could to stop the war. So he had an epiphany. So Dan Ellsberg was a fascinating interview. I interviewed Seymour Hersh, the investigative reporter who just on one source of his at the Pentagon gave him a tip. And from that one tip, he found Lieutenant Kelly and tracked down many other members of Lieutenant Kelly's AmeriCal division who were responsible for massacring hundreds of civilians at My Lai. And he told me his story. So I found people like that. Tom Hayden, who was the founder of SDS, Students for Democratic Society. Erica Huggins, who was a well-known member of the Black Panthers. Stephen Stills and Country Joe McDonald, who both played at Woodstock. It was a very diverse group of people, members of the Weather Underground, like Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers and Mark Rudd. So all of these people agreed to trust me with their stories. And what I think made the book a little bit different was it was all in their own voice. Mm-hmm. And I also think that is what makes the book a little emotionally compelling, because each one of them had very emotional, traumatic stories to tell of what happened to them during this year. And hearing it directly from them instead of, you know, from me, for the reader, makes for a more visceral and emotionally palpable reading experience.
It's almost like a documentary film in text, the way it's presented.
No, exactly. And I just finished making a documentary before I wrote this book, so that I had that in mind, of course. Right.
So you mentioned some of the famous people. What about the common citizen, the witnesses to this year? What was a compelling story for you, Clara Bingham?
There are so many that we'd never heard of. One of my favorite ones is a woman named Lori Moss, who was famously photographed next to Nixon at dawn on May 9th of 1970, when Nixon made a curious trip to the Lincoln Memorial. And at the time, about 100,000 anti-war protesters were convening on Washington, D.C., because they were very upset about the invasion of Cambodia, which Nixon had announced on May 1st, and then subsequently the death of the four students at Kent State. So Nixon went with just one aide, Bud Crow, and a very small Secret Service detail. It was a complete surprise, not scheduled, to the Lincoln Memorial to talk to students there. And Lori Moss was photographed with him. She was a young social worker who lived in Detroit and just driven overnight to go to the protest. And her photograph was plastered all over the front pages of the newspapers the next day. And I found her. She's now a therapist living outside of L.A. And it was fascinating to hear her story about how that one photograph, that one moment talking to Nixon, actually changed her life.
In what way? How did it change her life?
Well, she went back to work the next day, and she was a straight social worker. And in the photograph, she had long hair, and she was wearing an army jacket and was clearly a hippie. And so her boss fired her. And she was sort of leading a double life. And this was a period where it was still not really, you know, socially acceptable in straight society to be a hippie. And so she decided to drive across country with her boyfriend, who she'd picked up hitchhiking. And they drove across to Berkeley and lived in a commune. And she became an experimental therapist and a lesbian.
Wow.
So she did something that a lot of people in that generation or in that movement of social change at the time did, which is she gave up all of the restrictions of her, you know, 1950s and early 60s childhood and all the expectations that her parents had for her, and found her star. She found her own expression for who she was and really changed her life because of history.
She became the authentic self at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Clara, who would you have liked to have interviewed that you could not get, was not available, maybe was not alive? Who would that have been?
Oh, Abby Hoffman. Who's dead. I wish I could have interviewed him. I quote him in the book because he wrote a lot. He wrote Woodstock Nation and Steal This Book and these wonderful short sort of pamphlet like manifestos of the time. And he was so articulate and funny and wild. And I talked to his lawyer, Jerry Lefcourt, who represented him among many others, the Panther 21, most famously. And Jerry just, listening to Jerry Lefcourt talk about Abby Hoffman made me really wish I could have met him.
Absolutely. You were a little child during that 1 year, about 6 years old. Do you feel that you missed out? You would have liked to have been there?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I did the book. I had this really, I grew up on the Upper West Side and Central Park was my playground, but it was also the staging ground for the anti-war movement and every other protest that was going on at the time. The second wave feminist movement was just coming to life in 1970. And so was the environmental movement. Earth Day was in April of 1970. So all of these protests and rallies took place, you know, right outside my front door. And so I was very young. And in a way, it informed my life in almost an unconscious way. And I realized when I graduated from college in 1985, I owed a lot to the generation who had come before me.
The book is Witness to the Revolution. Clara Bingham is the author. Clara, thanks so much for joining us once again on America Weekend.
Thank you for having me, Valerie.
I'm Valerie Smaldone, and this is the Envision Radio Network.
America.
Now, cheap psych tricks with Dr. Buff.
And Dr. Buff here. Did you know that eating chocolate can add years to your life and life to your years? Well, it's the perfect food, especially dark chocolate. It's right up there with one of the finest gifts from the gods, or at least that's what the ancient Aztecs thought. And today's modern medicine agrees. Here's the science of it. It all started with 8,000 Harvard University alumni. Researchers checked out their life histories, things like do they drink, smoke, are they overweight, and how much red meat do they eat? And all things being equal, technically covaried, those who ate chocolate lived almost a year longer than those who didn't.
Remember, kid, with great chocolate comes great responsibility.
So what's the cheap psychological trick? Well, it's rare that something supposedly so bad is so good for you. So, bottom line, eat chocolate, live longer. Check out my book, Cheap Psychological Tricks for Lovers, at drbuff.com.
Just because you don't have time to read a book doesn't mean you can't enjoy stories about artists and groups that you love. To discover a whole new world of audiobooks and hear the stories that made the music, visit happylandaudio.com. That's happylandaudio.com.
Order in the court.
This is attorney Jay Coleman with The Final Verdict. Dan's car was stopped at a residential stop sign when Martha rammed him from behind. Dan jumped out of his car, shaking his fists, and angrily yelled, "I should punch you in the face." Even though the accident was Martha's fault, she filed assault charges against Dan. But since Dan didn't touch Martha or her car, do you think the assault charges will stick? The final verdict after this.
Just because you don't have time to read a book doesn't mean you can't enjoy stories about artists and groups that you love. To discover a whole new world of audiobooks and hear the stories that made the music, visit happylandaudio.com. That's happylandaudio.com.
Dan shook his fist so vigorously and his face was so red, Martha truly believed she was in danger. For assault charges to be valid, Martha only needed to believe she was going to be harmed. And that's the final verdict.